This is the United States Eventing Association's official podcast. Hello and welcome to episode 223. I'm Chris Stafford, and on the first episode of 2019, we're going to kick off the season with an educational series presented by Marcia Kulak. Marcia will be setting the scene with a segment on better management for better results. And that will be a little later on in the program, but we begin with a segment on safety. And this is intended to help you set up a plan and establish protocols in the event of an emergency. Well, joining me now is Rusty Lowe, who's a retired fire and EMS captain. He's still an instructor. He's very involved and, of course, have been volunteering with the sport now for a number of years. Rusty, welcome to the program and a Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Glad to be here.
Well, you do so many things for safety and obviously in the education of the safety aspects of specifically for the human element for riders at events. And I think there's so many things to cover under this topic of safety, Rusty. And I know you were at convention last year. You were educating people on new equipment and there were courses and online training. There was a lot of things that you were in your remit or in your hemisphere, so to speak. So I thought we'd start to map some of these things out and talk about some of the things that are important to the membership. Where would you like to begin?
Well, I think prevention always is the key. We always have to be ready to respond if something happens. But I think in the sport, we have done a good job in the past as far as providing excellent medical care at events. We've beefed that up. We have worked on the safety equipment for many years, starting with the helmets back in, I can't remember when we got the rule for mandatory ASTM helmets. We've got the protective vest. We now have the inflatable vest. And a lot of work has been done within the sport as far as the technical side of the sport, where we really have made a lot of strides in the past few years. It's taken several people to come together to get that done, and I'm proud to look back and see what we have done as a sport all together to improve safety. But where I worry the most now, I think that everybody's pretty well taken care of at a competition. If the organizer is playing by the rules and has the proper medical coverage on hand, I think our riders and our spectators are in pretty good shape. What I worry about is when they go back home. A lot of people live in rural areas that are a long way from EMS response. A lot of people do clinics and have a good many people on their property or at a facility at the same time, and they're not as well protected. So I think my mission right now, my focus, as most of what it was at the annual meeting, was to, educate people about what type of equipment is out there that's relatively inexpensive, what type of training is out there that is very inexpensive, and get people prepared to do to provide aid should a catastrophe occur while they're at home or if they're somewhere else outside of the competition setting. Since I retired from the fire department in September, I do some consulting work for a company that distributes automatic external defibrillators, bleeding control supplies, and we also teach from basic first aid and CPR and AED use all the way up to advanced type courses for medical professionals. So, my focus not only within the sport now is it's anywhere. People need to be prepared for an accident to happen. Someone can bleed to death in just a matter of minutes. Someone's in cardiac arrest, if CPR is not done and an AED is not used prior to EMS arrival, we don't have a very good chance of resuscitating the person. So it's very important that that I think non-medical people and others that are not professionally trained what to do know just a basic amount of first aid, CPR, and AED use and bleeding control to be able to begin aid prior to a professional rescue arriving on the scene.
Well, you touched upon those important first aid, that first time, the immediate response to someone, maybe it be on the yard, it be in the barn, in the training paddocks, wherever it may be, at home and in competition. Rusty, I mean, there's so many simple things that we could do. It's just a matter of educating ourselves. So just unpack that a little bit for us and how people can go about not just helping themselves in those situations, helping others.
Sure. Well, there's all sorts of training available. Several organizations within the United States that offer training courses, and it's very simple. The courses used to be more complicated, but as time has gone on, we figured out more and more that if we can train people how to do CPR, what to do for somebody that's choking, if they can take care of somebody that's bleeding profusely, and use an EpiPen or Narcan for a possible opioid overdose. These are things that can make a huge difference in just a short period of time. And if people kind of stick to these items, which are taught in these courses, they're going to be able to make a huge difference. Anything else, broken bones are bad. A concussion is bad and things like that, but it's not going to immediately cause death or permanent disability. So, if somebody's able to recognize these serious emergencies and provide these simple procedures prior to the arrival of a professional rescuer, that person's chances of survival is just much greater. If someone's in cardiac arrest, they're not breathing, they don't have a pulse, within 4 to 6 minutes, brain death can start to occur. And even if you do live or are in a region where you have good EMS response that might be 3 to 5 minutes, you're still playing with some valuable time there. So if the person's provided CPR, if an AED is available and it's used, the chances of survival go way up. Every minute that something's not done to a person in cardiac arrest, they're losing 10% of their chance of survival. So, if you get into 3 and 4 minutes, you're really playing with some valuable time there. Same way if somebody's bleeding profusely. They can bleed out real quickly, and something as simple as knowing how to put a pressure bandage on and use a tourniquet for severe bleeding can make all the difference in the world.
So let's just talk through those first steps then. You're at home, you're not even at a competition and have the benefit of emergency services arriving momentarily, but you're at home, there's no one there except you and maybe your students, or maybe your coach has a heart attack, that sort of thing. What are those first steps then? I mean, is it essential that anyone listening to this, they have someone at home in the barn who is trained in first aid and CPR? Or is there anything that you can convey to them today, Rusty, that would be the first steps to, as you say, applying that emergency protocols before a professional arrives?
Right. Well, the first thing is, of course, get the training. And there's several different ways, easier ways now to get the training, which we can talk about in a few minutes. But always have a plan. It never hurts, and it doesn't have to be sophisticated. It's who your people are that are trained, where your equipment is, and immediately how to dial 911 or the emergency number in your community. Some communities, especially if there's a lot of cell phones, the 911 system can't pinpoint the location quickly of the cell phone, so it may be easier to call a regular emergency number. But, good communication with your local provider helps as well. So the biggest thing is for a person to recognize the emergency, recognize what's going on, and then be able to put in action a set of steps as far as what to do. Now, it may be just holding the person still and calling 911. But then again, it may be if it's a serious accident and somebody's bleeding severely or, maybe not breathing and needs CPR. Where's the equipment that we have on site to take care of these emergencies? Who knows how to use it? And the biggest thing is just to have a plan, because everybody's facility is going to be a little bit different. Everybody's local community response is going to be different. So doing your work ahead of time and pre-planning and just kind of what if, all right, well, what if Susie falls in the lower 40 and she's got a bad head injury and she needs assistance? how are we going to summon aid? How are we going to make sure that the EMS folk can be directed in a timely manner? And, you know, who is going to do what? And, you know, always have a plan B, plan C. You know, always assume that your perfect plan is going to go wrong, because I can promise you, just when you think you have everything inked in black and white, you're going to go look for that person that's qualified for help, and they've gone to lunch. They've gone to get everybody something to eat. So, you know, what is your plan B? Is there someone else that's trained? You know, where is everything located to handle this emergency? So, and your local EMS folks would be glad to help you with it, because when they respond to, you know, let's say your address is 1234 Anyway Highway in America. Well, you may have 50 acres there, and on any one of those 50 acres, the accident may be, excuse me, they may be able to get to your address very quickly, but to get them to the victim within your property, that presents another problem. So good, responsible EMS providers like to get out and call it pre-incident planning, where we learn the people, we learn the property, and know that when we get a call to Chris Stafford's farm on Anywhere Highway, all right, that the barn, as soon as you go in the gate on the left, and the emergency plan is to have somebody standing there to show us where to go. But if they're not there, we know that the lower 40 or the show jumps are in the arena just over the hill. And it just helps them know what to do too. And it decreases a lot of stress for everybody in an emergency situation. And, you know, always practice your plan. Don't just get it together and file it away, because different people change and things change with time. And so you want to make sure you keep your plan up to date. It's something that nobody really wants to talk about. You know, you don't really want to sit down to dinner every night and talk about this, but it's something that does need to be talked about and then practiced on a regular basis.
Well, there are two very important, I think, and easy steps to take. As you said, have the EMS, your local services, come out and do a recce so they know exactly where the back 40 is, as you say. That's something that anyone can do. And who would they call right away then to do that, Rusty? Who would be the first?
There should be a non-emergency number for the EMS, or whether it's local, or whether it's county, city, or private. There should be a non-emergency number for them. Call them up and ask them, you know, tell them the situation and ask them if they would like to come out and meet at some point in time and view the property. And I can't imagine any of them would say no.
Now, the other thing you mentioned was calling from your cell phone, because often you see on your phone this doesn't take 911 calls.
Right.
Something that we should educate ourselves on, and, you know, what steps do we take if we don't have a landline? You know, how do we go? What do we do? Do we call a non-emergency service, even though it's a life-threatening situation, simply because we can't get through on a 911 call on our mobile?
Right. The 911 calls usually go through, but what the problem is, when you call from a landline, the number appears on their screen and they know exactly where you're calling from. When you call from a cell phone, it has to be triangulated, and the cellular companies have been mandated to work on this to better locate where the cell phones are. And as you know, most people are switching over to total cellular. So there's kind of a rush for 911 centers and the cellular providers to have better ability to locate exactly where the person is, and they're headed in the right direction. But if some communities, like I remember back in the days of Foxhall, at Foxhall Farm in Georgia, when we had an emergency and need to call in additional assistance, you could dial 911 from anywhere on the property on your cell phone, and you would get Fulton County 911 across the river. Well, Foxhall's in Douglas County, so immediately you had to tell them, see, please transfer me to Douglas County. And in certain situations, Douglas County or whomever county might tell you, well, to avoid that, just call this number direct. It's an emergency number, but it's not 911, and that just kind of takes that step out of the process. Because sometimes a cell call can be passed around, especially if the, you know, the cell tower that the phone hits, if it's in another municipality or it's in another county, it'll ring you to the wrong place. And so quickly you have to make sure you're talking to the right people and that they transfer you to the right place. So that would be the situation where maybe the people in your community say, hey, call this number that gets us direct rather than go through 911. It's a smoother process. But that's something that's going to be specific to everybody's property in the U.S. and abroad as to where the cell phone actually activates the tower that's going to get the 911 people. So once again, a good meeting with your provider, your local provider, can help you come up with a plan and see what's best, whether to call direct by a number or continue to call 911, which is the best. But sometimes in certain locations, there can be a short delay in getting the call to the right responders.
All right, good to know. Now, the other thing you mentioned, which I think is very simple for us to, you know, to do on a regular basis, is a drill, like a fire drill.
Right.
Have a safety drill and go through those what-if scenarios, and especially when you have new personnel coming. So I'm wondering how often you would recommend those kind of safety drills, just to keep everybody refreshed and make sure, you know, that the first aid person that got trained in CPR, you know, if they're off site that day, as you say, or maybe they leave, you have to make sure you've got someone else or even more than one person on site who is trained. So how often would you suggest then that we go through a safety drill?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm the safety geek, so I'm going to recommend if I could talk right, I'm going to recommend about once a month. Now, most people, that's probably hard to do. But I would say at least quarterly. If you do it once a month, that would just be great. But at least quarterly, and it may be just something as simple as you just walk in right before the lesson and say, all right, what are you going to do if I come running to the barn and tell you that Susie has fallen down behind the indoor arena? What are you going to do? And just let that person go through the steps and just say, okay, where's the first aid kit? Where's the bleeding equipment? Where's the AED? Where's the fire extinguisher? And all of that stuff really can be stored together. And that's really what we're trying to educate people now with bleeding control and CPR and first aid, is keep that equipment together. Have your fire extinguisher, have your AED, have your bleeding or your first aid kit all together. And that way, in a prominent location where if somebody needs to get it, and even somebody that may be in a panic situation, they could remember where it is, they can see it, and they can run and grab whatever equipment's necessary.
And also, of course, to remember that when there has been an emergency, maybe some of that equipment, a first aid kit, has been used to make sure it's restocked.
Correct. You know, whoever your vendor is that sold you the equipment, or if you may have a boarder that's a medical professional that can get you some equipment and put you a little bag together, just have a plan to restock, because just because one thing's happened doesn't mean something else is not going to happen. And don't think that two things can't happen at the same time. So that's something to factor into the drill. You know, if you're going to have to split ways by chance there were two falls at the same time, or let's say, you know, someone's grandfather has a heart attack on the property right after granddaughter falls off her horse. You know, what are you going to do in that situation? And, you know, it's one of these things where you don't wish this on anybody. You don't want it to happen, but it does happen, and you need to be prepared for it.
Well, of course, the other eventuality is that the horse is injured too.
Correct.
So you're then splitting your resources. Who do you take care of first? You know, the horse or the rider, and if there may be not enough people on site. There's so many variables that can happen,
sure.
Rusty. I think it's just important to know how to prioritize. So give us an example of then, okay, the horse has fallen. He's not getting up either, no more, and the rider isn't any more than he is. So, and there's only one person in the arena at the time. What happens next?
Well, you know, that's a tough situation there. And we refer to it as triage in the professional rescuer world, where we look at the situation and see who can I do the most for at the moment. And, you know, if the horse is down, he's not moving, he's unconscious, you know, I don't know what vet training the person may have. And it may be, you know, make the phone call to 911, make a phone call to the vet. And then, you know, if there's something you might could do for the horse, you could, and then attend to the human. And, you know, the other end of that is if the horse is down and unconscious and you have the rider close, you know, do we need to move the rider out of the way in case the horse wakes up and he's not going to be happy because he's either injured or, you know, it's kind of groggy waking up from whatever happened. So you have to remember everybody's safety there. But that's a tough call. And I know a lot of people have some veterinary training, and it's, you just got to see who you can do the most for at the moment. And unfortunately, sometimes with our animal companions, you know, we can't do a whole lot till the vet gets there. So, but if it's something that you can, you know, quickly, like put a pressure bandage on the horse if he's bleeding or something like that, put something on it, and then attend to the person and see. And, you know, some people, when they're unconscious, you know, we can keep them still, we can keep their head still. If they're breathing and have a pulse and they're not bleeding severely, there's not a whole lot we can do for them until it's just monitoring their condition and then until the professional rescuers arrive. So it may be, you know, you may have to say, well, the human here, I've done all I can, and I'll watch to make sure they don't stop breathing or have any worse problems than they're having now, and maybe we can do something for the horse. So it's just one of those situations you don't want to be in, but you just kind of have to assess who you can do the most for at the moment and make sure that both the horse and the rider are safe.
And it's so important, as you say, to get some training, even for anyone on site has that training to understand, you know, when you're in that situation, you instinctively may panic, but it, you know, it's no good to panic because you have to keep your head on and do what you can do the most for, who you can do the most for in the moment. And often there are young personnel here, we're talking about Rusty, who may have had no experience of being in an accident situation. So even more important that whoever is responsible for the barn then makes sure everyone understands the protocols.
Right, and I think that's what we see the most of when people panic. They don't know what to do. They haven't had the training. They don't know what's going on in the barn. They don't know the procedure. So the more the person is trained or at least advised of what's going on and what they need to do in the situation, it can kind of kick in automatically, and that helps. I think the people that I've heard the most that have panicked the most are the ones that say, well, I didn't know what to do. I didn't have anything to do anything with. I didn't know I was supposed to do this. I didn't know I was supposed to do that. But the people that at least have a basic understanding of the plan and just a basic understanding of what to do in a situation like that, it decreases the chance of chaos and confusion. But also, we know we all have the friends that no matter what happens and no matter how much you educate them, they're going to be the ones to panic. So those are also the people that may be the best one to send to the gate and escort the EMS folks in, get them out of the way, assign them a project. And that's a very important project, is getting the EMS responders to where you are. So it's kind of like back in the old days when they told the husband to go boil water. You know, it's just kind of a task for this person. It's just kind of a task for this person to do, and they may be very good at it. And but they're the one that's going to fall apart when anything happens. So that's the person you want to assign a task to that they can accomplish, but that even if they're panicking, they can still do that.
Yeah, so you still play a very important part in this. And just to recap now then, obviously the CPR training is important. Where do members go to learn about that if they don't have a plan in place, they don't have anyone trained in CPR, Rusty?
You have your local American Red Cross, your Heart Association, and things like that. My company can provide the training nationwide. The Stop Heart Attack and Trio Safety, we can do that as well. Our website is www.stopheartattack.com. Please give me a call if I can help you. Or, you know, if there's a local agency and local company that you're familiar with and have used before, by all means, whoever you're comfortable with, please use. But we have a lot easier ways to train now. A lot of people used to tell me in the past, well, I don't have time to take a CPR course. I've got to ride 5 horses a day. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. I've got to be in, I've got to be at Tryon this weekend, and there's just no time for it. Well, now we have what we call the blended courses, which I did at the annual meeting in December, is where you can go online, and the Red Cross does it, the Heart Association does it, other organizations do it. You go online and you do all the academics per se online. You have the classroom training online. You take your test online, you handle all that online, and you're issued a certificate that says you've completed that part. Then you go to a skills session where you prove your skills. You actually demonstrate CPR for the instructor. They can remediate if they need to. You demonstrate bleeding control. You basically get tested on the practical skills that you've learned online. And that takes about an hour to do, depending on the size of the group. And what I want to try and organize this year is to have people at different events, maybe some of the larger ones where we have a good volume of people there, to go ahead and get their training online. And then I can say, okay, I'm going to be at Red Hills, Tuesday through Saturday or Tuesday through Friday. And at certain times you can come to where I'm located and we can check off your skills. And then that completes your certification. It's all done. So when you're sitting at home at night, you can do your online training. You can stop it and return to it as you need to. And then find out where there's a skill session that's going to be. We can check you off fairly quickly because typically we're in one site at an event or at a meeting and can do that. And I think we can get a lot more people trained that way because it's better time management. The training is a lot more simple than it used to be. It focuses on the true life-threatening emergencies and not necessarily on the bee stings and the small cuts. And, we can get a lot of people trained out there and equipment as well. My company, we do sell the AEDs. We do sell bleeding control and other items that are, life-saving made easy, per se, with the equipment. But, there's other vendors out there that you may know, someone in your community or whatever. But if you don't, we are glad to help.
Well, this is great advice, Rusty, and important for all of our members to understand those safety protocols, have a plan in place, as you say. Any final message, Rusty, that you would like to give our members when it comes to this topic, all important topic to everybody?
Well, I think the message there is be prepared, have a plan, and get the training somehow, whatever's easiest for you. I don't mind talking to someone and steering them in the right direction if I can't help them. There's equipment that's out there that's relatively inexpensive people need to keep on hand. And just think about what might happen. Think about what your plan is and think about what you might need in your situation to handle an emergency. And if you need any assistance, I'm glad to help. There's other safety coordinators and safety officers at events around the country that will be glad to help you, give you some advice. And, we like being presented with situations like that because we all know how important it is. The more people you have trained, the more equipment that's out there, the greater chance of saving a life there's going to be. And so, the life you save may be your own. So that's something to think about as well.
Absolutely. Be prepared. Well, great advice, Rusty. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to come on the program and talk us through this. And as always, as you say, they can find more information on the website anyway at useventing.com. So again, thanks for everything you're doing to help us when it comes to safety, Rusty. Really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to do it. And I'm always available.
And our thanks again to Rusty. And if you would like more information on safety plans and protocols, please contact the office. You can find the number, of course, on the website at useventing.com. And joining me now to begin our new education series is Marcia Kulak. Marcia, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the program.
Chris, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, there's so many aspects that we could cover in good management, in any educational aspect of horse welfare and management, isn't there? But you're going to start, I believe, at a very timely part of the year, of course, now, coming into January, and that's a very, very good time to do a complete evaluation. And I think you're calling this Better Management for Better Results. Is that right?
Correct, correct. And what I hope to give everyone is a pathway to greater success through tweaking their management. And as you mentioned, January is a good time to reassess your program, both taking a hard look at last year, how successful were you, what are your strengths and weaknesses, and how might you take some steps to improve this year. I think we all are aware of the risks involved in eventing, so safety is high on everybody's radar. And what I hope to share is how can we enhance safety, but also the enjoyment and the success you have out of the sport, be it at beginner novice or all the way through the levels. And I think that there are several things that challenge us today. First of all, most adult amateurs board their horses. So there is a disconnect often between what goes on in the management of the horse because they are busy with life as family members or raising a family, running a business of some other sort, or just having a job. So I think it's important for owners and riders to understand that they need to try and assess their horses through their team, because clearly they may not be the one that is taking care of the horse on a daily basis. So that's where I thought I would start. Again, we said New Year's is a great time to reassess your program. First thing I would do would be to decide what your goals are for the new year and evaluate honestly your strengths and weaknesses from your previous year. And then you have to assemble your team. Your team's probably most important ingredient is your trainer, and developing a really strong, open, honest line of communication with your trainer is extremely important. But then throughout that team process, you're obviously going to have your veterinarian and your farrier that are going to play very key roles in keeping your horse healthy and sound. So here we are in January. Let's evaluate your horse physically. And I think that it's very important to put the team together. In other words, you pay to have your veterinarian come. You pay to have your farrier come. Why not have them come on the same day? And let's get an evaluation of the horse from a veterinary perspective and include often the most underrated member of the team is the farrier. And I think sometimes the farrier gets blamed for things when the system starts to break down or the horse falls apart, loses a shoe, takes a lot of foot with it, gets foot sore when the ground is hard. You know, there are many things. So I really like to make sure that my trainer, the farrier, and the vet all have a really good line of communication. And if you put that team together and you articulate to those people how important it is to you, the owner, the one paying the bills, for them to work together in an honest way for the betterment of the horse. And I've never known anybody, Chris, to not want to hear that, you know, from an owner who genuinely wants to do the very best they can. So I think that's a great starting point.
Yeah, it certainly is. And there's so many pieces to this, as you say, getting your team to assembling your team and then looking at the kind of things you mentioned, their strengths and weaknesses, the kind of things that you really do have to take a hard look at and be quite honest, really, especially when it comes to the weaknesses and where you need to focus in your preparation for the next season.
Yeah, and I even think it goes so far as to say, are your goals realistic? You know, if you're competing at a level, is one of the three phases really weak? Or are you continually having repetitive issues? Are your dressage scores poor? Is your horse melting down? Does he have a ditch or a water issue? Are you as a rider fearful? What are the mental aspects of what you're doing? So, first of all, I think you address the horse. I feel it's really important for the horses also to be well-handled and well-behaved. There's nothing more difficult for a veterinarian or a farrier than to work on a horse that won't jog up properly, won't stand quietly in the cross ties, or needs to be held and having an appropriate person to hold them. I think it's really hard to expect a farrier, for instance, to be able to give his best work if he doesn't have adequate light, isn't fighting the flies, has someone to hold a horse, or that it cross ties quietly, and is in a position to do his best work. And we really have a responsibility to set your farrier up for success, not just have him drive in and go, oh no, you know, I'm going to have to shoe this horse with bad fly situation in the mud, it's a rainy day, you know, whatever the circumstances. I believe that we have a responsibility to help the farrier do the best job he can. And the value of that is twofold. One, your horse is going to get certainly a much better shoeing job. But I also think that the farrier then will recognize that you value his work and his level of importance, or hers, and is much more willing to, you pull a shoe off, they'll come more readily and put it back on for you. They know that there's accountability on the other end. So I think if you put that out there to them, that you want the best work they can provide, and your team is willing to make that easier for them, I think that's important. And I can't say enough that if the veterinarian finds something that needs to be tweaked because the horse has a conformational weakness, let's say, and his heels tend to get run under and he's got a long toe, how can they take perhaps some radiographs of the feet, share that with the farrier on the same day, and show how we can help improve this horse's way of going through better shoeing. And, you know, I touch on everything that you do obviously costs some degree of money. There's a cash outlay. But if you spend your money wisely by putting your team together in a functional way, then I think in the end you get a lot more bang for your buck.
Yes, that makes absolute sense. And of course, there are other members of this team as well. Do you want to expand on that and who it might be wise to be able to get them to come, if not at the same time as the vet and the farrier, Marcy, but maybe on the same day or within that same period of time, so you can see the horses as they are at any one point in their training and development?
Correct. Yes, if it's not possible to team them up at the same time, I think that it's best to have the vet look at the horse first, do full flexions, lunge the horse on a hard surface and a soft surface, and also preferably watch the horse go under saddle. I don't think that a horse goes the same way on a lunge line that they do under saddle. And some of the training issues that we are feeling, you know, we change bits or we use a different martingale or what have you, might actually, and in many cases do, arrive as a result of a physical problem in the horse. So here we are trying to change our training, which might need to happen, but perhaps solving some of the discomfort that the horse is experiencing will then make your training go much smoother and much more successfully. So if the vet and the farrier, again, can't come on the same day, let them communicate. Indicate to the vet that you want an open line of communication with the farrier, and let the farrier know that the vet's going to call so we can all be on the same page in the playbook. Now, as a trainer myself, I take the responsibility of that job. If you're an owner and you have a full-time job, you're obviously going to have to rely on a key person in the organization, probably your trainer, to fill that role more readily. But I do think it's very important to have an expectation that the trainer is willing and able to do that. And that's important. You know, we're all busy. I understand that. But I really believe that as a professional, I have an obligation to fulfill that job. You know, if I'm being paid as a trainer by my owners for that very reason. So, again, opening this line of communication is very important. And then you have to be sure that you indicate to your key people that this is what you're expecting.
And I know this is slightly digressing again, but it's that time of the year. It's January. It's probably a good time over the winter to reevaluate your trainer and your vet and your farrier. Have you got the right team together? I mean, if you're happy with everybody,
that's great, right? Yeah, and sometimes we tiptoe around that situation. But I really think that I say to all of my owners, you know, none of us are getting any younger. So how long do you want to spin your wheels? or do you want to spin your wheels? So, yeah, as an owner, as a rider, particularly an adult amateur, I think many people come back into this sport to enjoy it later in life. You know, many amateurs rode as young riders and then went on and had a career. They've raised a family. They're on now. They want to come back into the sport. And I believe that you have to be really honest, and you have to decide as a rider, what's the best training situation for you? Do you like a small boutique barn? Do you want to be in a bigger, more socially oriented barn? But in the end of the day, you need to be safe. You need to feel like you're having fun. The fun factor, to me, has to be very high. And then if you're going to spend the time and money and effort to compete, you really would like to be successful. And success can mean a lot of different things. It doesn't necessarily mean winning a blue ribbon every weekend, but wouldn't you like to feel that the measure of your effort, of your money, of your time, and of your hard work, that you have something to show for it when you go to an event, that you're competent enough to be competitive. So I do agree with you, Chris. You have to look hard at your team and say, do I have the right team for what it is that I want to do? And that requires, you know, commitment and a frank discussion with your current team or exploring other possibilities, other possibilities with other professionals. But you got to take a hard look at it. And sometimes, you know, it's a little bit of a difficult situation. But what I just articulated, I think, is really important. We're not getting any younger. We want to have fun and we want to be safe. So you've got to put together the right balance of people to do that.
Right. And having done that, taking that hard, honest look, really, and not being afraid to do that, not being afraid to have those hard conversations with your coach, because it may be just a subtle change, and it may be that, you know, just a fresh approach to any aspects of your horse management team is going to help you, because maybe the horses have moved up a level. Maybe you've got new horses. Maybe you're an amateur.
Right.
You know, that, you as you say, the most important thing is that you remember you're doing it for fun. So if there's any part of that that's just not fun, well, it's like any sport. Why do we do it? You know?
Right. And, you know, we've touched on getting your veterinarian and your farrier together. Once the veterinarian has made some suggestions, let's say the horse is slightly underweight, maybe looks like it's got some ulcers, what are the best ways to implement some changes in the program, not just putting them on ulcer medication, which may be absolutely vital, but is the horse getting sufficient turnout? Is he getting quality forage? Is the nutritional side of your program correct? And most owners who board their horses don't have a real understanding of that. Now, the good thing is that many feed companies offer nutritional support and in fact will send a professional to work with your trainer and say, okay, let's evaluate the feeding program for this particular horse, and here are our suggestions that could help you with that. So with the advent of, you know, the internet, obviously there's good information. You have to sift through it and make sure that it's all, you know, correct and accurate for what you need. But I think enhancing a trainer's position to be well-educated and to do things better puts you in a positive light, on a positive path with your trainer, rather than when things have fallen apart, everybody's unhappy and then trying to approach a way to fix it. Let's perhaps fix it before we're trying to go out and compete and get on a schedule. Let's do it now. And as I say, there are a lot of key things with event horses or performance horses, like nutrition, like quality hay, turnout program, how you manage ulcers, how you manage saddle fit. The list that I have in front of me is incredibly long, but this is a good time to do it, where you iron out what you think you could do better and go and take the steps to do that. So January is a great time because there's generally less pressure on people to adhere to a competition schedule. So this is a good time for you to communicate that you as an owner and a rider want to take a degree of responsibility for how you're going to be successful. And I think most trainers would welcome that. And if you run into a problem where they're not so comfortable with that, then again, what you mentioned a moment ago about perhaps making some changes is a valuable conversation to have.
Yeah, and you mentioned, as you said, there's such a long list of the different aspects of horse management these days. Mm-hmm. And there are the specialists too. We mentioned the farrier and vet are the obvious ones, but there's the physio and there's different therapies too, yep. Isn't there? You mentioned saddle fitting. This is all part of your team. These are all people in the team. And if you haven't maybe explored saddle fitting before, you need to get some recommendations. That's the other aspect of this. Whose advice do you follow? Say, if you are a very much an adult amateur here, Marcia, and you've never thought of saddle fitting before, or you've never thought about a certain type of therapy, whose advice do you follow?
Well, saddle fit has become a very high-profile topic because saddles have changed a lot, and I think that it's important for a person to educate themselves. What kind of a saddle are you riding in? Does it fit your horse? How do you determine that? So you have to do some homework. Now, most good trainers are well aware of the progression that saddle fitting and saddlery has made in general. So, but if they don't happen to know as much as you think might be best for you, then you have to work on educating yourself. And again, there are a couple of very high-profile companies. There are some very good books to read. Jochen Schlese wrote a book about saddle fit and with exceptional photos and diagrams. And so there is a way to enhance your own education. If you're not lucky enough to be in the South right now, you could do some nighttime reading when it's 20 degrees and you're not going to be at the barn. You can educate yourself and then take some steps to find some saddle fitters, talk with them, get a feel of their knowledge, and you got to give it a try. I think you've got to hire someone to come look at your tack and give you what you hope is some education and some answers as to how your tack might fit better. And many veterinarians now are recognizing that saddle fit is contributing tremendously to back soreness, wither soreness. And so these horses that become sore in their top line then start to get very sore in their feet or very sore in their hocks. So there's this cumulative effect. And I do think that you have to be careful because some trainers are sponsored by a saddle company and feel completely obligated for their clients to ride in a specific piece of equipment. That might narrow the field too much for you or for your horse. So again, I think it's important to enhance your education and then take some steps to determine what might be the best fit for you as a rider. The rider has to be comfortable and in balance, but you also have to assure that your horse has adequate back comfort to perform well. So saddle fit is new, but a very important ingredient. And so once again, as an adult amateur, it would be important to enhance your own education about that topic so that you can try to determine if you're on the right track with the equipment that you're using. And Lord knows, Chris, all this equipment is expensive. So you hopefully want to make a good investment the first time, not just willy-nilly go buy a saddle and then realize that you've spent several thousand dollars and it is totally wrong for you or your horse. So that's a big feature right now in education, and I think a very important one.
And we should mention bits as well, because bits and bit fitting is becoming increasingly important. Again, it's another area where you can educate yourself on. And if you were lucky enough to come up through the ranks of British Horse Society system and Pony Club or whatever it may be, you do get that basic understanding of bits and saddle and tack fitting, and particularly bits as well. But there are specialists now that will, hopefully they're independent, so they're not just going to sell you one type of bit, like one type of saddle or one make
right.
of saddle.
Right.
But wouldn't you agree that's another aspect where you can educate yourself on? Because there are so many choices of bits these days, Marcia.
It's mind-boggling, actually. I would start out by saying the first step is to get your veterinarian to align you with a good equine dentist. And that is part of your team, because many high-performance veterinarians that do lameness or internal medicine. Don't do dentistry. Very similar in human medicine. So there are equine dentists that are veterinarians. There are equine dentists that are not veterinarians, but that's all they do. Again, you need to work with your trainer. Your horse's mouth comfort is the first line of having them go well. Then bridle fitting and bidding would follow. One thing I would say is there are professionals who will come and let you try a variety of bits, which is very beneficial because if you're able to put that person together, say you invite a bit fitter to come on a day when half a dozen people at the barn could benefit. If you put that together, it may A, reduce the cost, but also increase the fun factor that everyone is trying something new. It helps educate your barn, your trainer. It's a win for everyone. And then, as we know, bits are very, very expensive. So if you have an opportunity to realistically try a bit and ride a horse in it and also have a bit professional explain to you, well, this one would help you achieve a little more flexion. This shape of bit would fit better in a horse's mouth that has a shallow palate, which your vet and dentist could also help you with. If you put that information together, you're simply spending your money in a wiser fashion because you have more information as to what bit your horse might actually be comfortable in. And why you use one, you know, a loose ring snaffle in the dressage may not be adequate control for you on the cross country. So do you step up to a Pelham or a gag or a little stronger snaffle? There are a myriad of choices. So having an opportunity to try them out before you buy them is really helpful. And as a professional, one of the things I do for my clients is I have a huge bit box. And when a new horse comes my way, I obviously like to start with the simplest quality snaffle that I can. But as we experiment with what we need for control, I'll go through my bit resume first, and then if they need to buy something, have them do that. And I find that's a much more effective way than going spending $300, $400, $500 in the course of a summer trying to find the right cross country bit for your horse. And I would bet that most trainers are generous enough to do that, but I do think it's a really important thing. It's a service I provide for my clients, is we try different tack or different equipment that belongs to me most of the time, and then make an educated decision whether or not we think that's a wise purchase. It's a service I offer, and I think it's very, very important.
So many aspects to look at, as you say. Now is the time, January, and in January, these weeks ahead, where things are a little bit quieter in the barn, and you can look at all of these things that Marcia has suggested here. And we could, of course, drill a lot deeper on any one of these topics, Marcia. So what would you like to cover next time? Do you have a thought on this educational series where you'd like to take this?
One thing I would like to say is that if you put your program together, as you put it together, and let's say you come up with a couple of issues that your horses have and they require some veterinary work, I always say to people that there's another competition down the road. So perhaps we back up and do one less competition and put that money into the maintenance of the horse. Let's say the horse needs to have its ulcers treated or needs to have its hocks injected, whatever. And people say, oh my gosh, that costs so much money. Well, Chris, when you think of the economics of going to an event, that costs a lot of money too. And if you're going to go and not be successful for reasons that are fixable, you need to do that. So that's one thing I'd like to kind of say in summary. When you're looking at enhancing and improving your program, the goal is to, in the end, improve your safety, the enjoyment of the sport, and your success. So you have to look at it that way. And while economics play a role, be smart about your economics. Don't keep competing and going down the same road if you're not having the results that you want. And I'll step up and say, if a rider is struggling, let's say they have some fears, mentally they have some challenges, I think it's very important for a trainer to say, all right, how can we help you on the mental side of your riding so that you can go to an event and be more competent under a pressure situation. So we've talked a lot about the horse. There's also a lot of considerations about the rider. How physically fit are you? How mentally fit are you? Eventing's a tough game. It's a big weekend or it's a big one day. And every part of the equation has got to be in order to really do it well. So we've talked a lot about the horse. There's also a lot to consider with the rider. I think we can take this a step further to talk about when a veterinarian does an evaluation, what's the best route to go? How would you further refine what you're expecting from your, you know, your spring tune-up?
That sounds wonderful. Well, let's follow that up next time, Marcia. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to come on the show and unpack this for us. Very timely, very valuable advice. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris, for having me, and the service you provide is tremendous.
And our thanks again to Marcia and to Rusty for kicking us off with this bumper episode as we begin 2019. Marcia will be back as we continue our educational series. And finally, a reminder, if you listen to this online and prefer to listen to it on the go, you can download it from iTunes to your podcast app and take it with you. Be sure to follow us on social media at US Eventing to catch when the next episode drops in 2 weeks' time. But for now, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world, and enjoy your eventing.